American. So there's a stumbling block right there. The Americans want to keep some troops in Afghanistan to go after ISIS and maybe al-Qaeda remnants. The Taliban, though, want all U.S. troops out. So the question, one of the big questions is, can there be a compromise in that point alone?
Tom, thanks very much for the insight. Really appreciate it.
You're welcome, Steve.
That's NPR Pentagon correspondent Tom Bowman. Now, what was the president's trip to Afghanistan like? NPR White House correspondent Franco Ordonez went along on Thanksgiving Day and is back in the United States. Hey there, Franco.
Hello.
Happy holiday to you. How did this trip unfold in secrecy?
Yeah, I think that was one of the most interesting aspects, certainly for me. I was part of a small group of reporters who met at an undisclosed parking garage near Joint Base Andrews on Wednesday night. We were brought to the base by some agents who checked our bags and took away our phones. They were confiscated for much of the trip. We were then driven in the dark to a hangar, and you could just barely see out of a door, kind of like this bright light shining through. And as we got a little closer, I could see the sky blue stripe of Air Force One. It was pretty fascinating.
Wow. And then you made the long trip to Afghanistan and you end up at Bagram Air Base outside of Kabul, right?
Yeah. It was a long trip. But interestingly, we found out during the trip that not only were our phones confiscated, but all staff, all the entire administration staff, all the top aides also had to take their phones. President Trump, for example, they had staffers sending out tweets for him.
Oh, so that it would appear that he was at the phone tweeting, as he often is, but actually he wasn't sending communications. What was it like once the president reached the ground? I've seen photos of him taking meals off a chow line and handing them to soldiers.
Yeah, he was handing out turkey with a lot of his aides. He got a strong welcome from the crowd. I mean, he spoke in front of big American flags, an Apache helicopter. It was a rousing. A lot of people were jumping to try to get pictures with him and selfies, and he seemed to enjoy himself.
But let's come back to the news here. We're trying to figure out if the president's statement about talks with the Taliban, if that's real, if it's a little premature, if it's just a remark. Did you get any sense from being around the president and the president's staff?
Well, I mean, certainly, it was definitely ear-catching and definitely caught our attention when he mentioned that the talks were resumed, and he mentioned specifically that the Taliban was interested in a ceasefire. That was the United States' demand before, but he said that he now believes that they are ready for a ceasefire. Now, we shall see if that's true. He did give that, I believe, caveat, and we've heard that kind of thing before from the president.
Franco, thanks very much, and welcome home.
Thank you.
NPR's Franco Ordonez.
At least one in seven mothers suffer from postpartum depression. Left untreated, this can have serious consequences for both moms and babies. The burden on women of color is especially heavy. They are three times more likely to experience postpartum depression and are also less likely to get treatment for it. Nina Feldman at member station WHYY in Philadelphia has our story.
Santino Adams is a talkative and precocious two-year-old.
Yeah, bubble.
Umbrella, right.
The rain.
Yes, the rain.
Rain won't close.
He's at home playing with his mom, Stephanie Lee, on their living room floor in Philadelphia. Santino is Lee's second son, and he was a surprise. At 37, she thought she was done raising kids.
Like, I was busy. I was out. It's like almost like I felt like Stella got her groove back. I got my groove back.
But even when she found out she was pregnant, Lee thought she could keep her momentum going.
I thought I was going to be able to work out until my ninth month and work up until my ninth. Like, I was like, I'm going to be in labor at work.
But about 5 months into her pregnancy, Lee had a procedure to prevent her from going into an unsafe early labor. It forced her to stay on bed rest.
It was so rough. Like, I was a mess. Like, I was crying.
Lee was stressed. She was worried about money and didn't feel like her friends or family understood what she was going through. The depression continued after Santino was born, too, but Lee felt embarrassed to ask for help.
The Black community don't know postpartum. It's like they look at it like, you need to be strong, girl. Like, my aunts and all of them went through, had 5, 6, 7 babies, and they all about 2, 3 years apart. Like, you only got one, and it's this expectation on us as women of color that, like, we have to be, like, these superhero strong, that we're not allowed to be vulnerable. I'm not allowed to have postpartum because I'm Black.
Underreporting of postpartum depression and the fear of being judged is pretty common for lots of women. But 27-year-old Ariel Dickey says that as a Black woman, she had another concern when she thought about asking for help. She also struggled with postpartum depression and was afraid her newborn daughter would be taken from her.
She's like so sweet and nurturing, like, whoa. Like if she sees me a little sad, she'll say, what's wrong? And she'll grab my face and kiss it.
After her maternity leave, Dickey went back to work. The separation felt overwhelming.
Sometimes I would be with my, like, talking to my boss and things, and I would have, like, this impulse of, like, I quit, you know, just because to me, in that moment, it's like, my time here isn't worth me being away from her.
That feeling lasted months. Dickey knew it was more than separation anxiety, but didn't dare utter the words postpartum depression.
I was scared, because it's just like, what if they think I'm, like, a danger to us? Oh, wait. Postpartum depression, that means you might, like, you want to harm yourself and the baby, you know, like, that whole thing.
Dickey says she worried that admitting she had depression would trigger a call to child welfare.
It's something that I've seen happen, like, seeing growing up, hearing stories of moms that, you know, like, they had their kid in, like, the most loving home and, like, for the slightest thing. Now you're under investigation, you know? It just didn't seem like a risk I was willing to take.
Her fears are warranted. Research shows child welfare workers judge Black mothers as unfit at a higher rate than white mothers, even when they have the same education and income level. It can also be harder to detect postpartum depression in women of color because they were mostly excluded when the screening tools were being created.
And so what we're stuck with is tools that weren't necessarily developed with these cultural nuances in mind.
That's psychiatrist Alfie Breland-Noble. She says screeners often ask questions using keywords like depression or anxiety, but different communities use different language.
So they'll say, I have the blues, I'm in my feelings, I don't feel right, something feels off. We have this old saying among Southern African-Americans where people will say nothing ain't wrong, but something ain't right. You know what I mean? So it's just this uneasiness. So those are the kinds of things I've encountered with people where they will sort of talk around depression, but nobody really wants to say that what they have is a mental illness like depression.
Even if women of color show signs of depression, getting treatment means even more challenges. Stacey Callum is a pediatrician at the Children's Hospital of Philadelphia. During the baby's first year, she screens new mothers for postpartum depression at each visit. If signs point to a problem, Callum refers them to mental health services. But once she had her own kid, she wondered, are the moms really going?
Literally just bundling up your child and leaving the house is an accomplishment in that immediate postpartum phase.
Callum did some research and found that in the 6 months after being diagnosed, only 1 in 10 mothers got any kind of treatment.
So first, you have to get yourself to the appointment. You have to arrange for childcare. And then on top of all of that, you might have depression. I mean, of course it's hard. Of course so many mothers aren't receiving services. The system isn't set up to be easy for them.
Eventually, both the Philadelphia moms, Stephanie Lee and Ariel Dickey, were able to get treatment. Lee's counselor actually came to her house, so it felt private and easy.
I don't know if words can, like, really describe how much it really did help me. And I think there needs to be, like, a campaign of, like, a bunch of faces of women of color that look like us so they know, like, I went through it too.
Treatment for postpartum depression is effective. Talk therapy and antidepressants usually work. The hardest part for most new moms is getting the help. For NPR News, I'm Nina Feldman in Philadelphia.
This story was reported in partnership with Aneri Patani of the Philadelphia Inquirer. This is NPR News.
19 past 8 now, and you're listening to Morning Edition on Wisconsin Public Radio. It's Friday and time for the next Wisconsin Life. In observance of the wildest shopping day of the year, we'll have a story about a thrift store sometimes called the Macy's of the North. That's coming up in 25 minutes.
There was a time when high-speed rail almost came to Wisconsin. Some people loved the idea.
So there were all these ideas, wants and desires and needs in the community that seemed to get tied together in this neat package.
But the project had its critics.
It was a bright, shiny object, but ultimately failed the test of common sense.
Derailed is a new podcast from WPR, where we explore what this train says about our increasingly divided state.
It's available now wherever you get your podcasts and at WPR.org.
Support for WPR comes from small businesses across the state. Saturday, November 30th is Small Business Saturday, a shopping holiday to support local business. WPR is proud of our sponsors. A full list is at wpr.org/sponsor.
Support for WGTD comes from Jack Andrea. Visit jackandrea.com to shop their exclusive hometown collection, including Kenosha t-shirts, sweatshirts, mugs, books, and more. Jack Andrea, Kenosha's hometown store since 1911.
In weather for today, flurries and freezing drizzle are possible, highs in the mid to upper 30s. Then tomorrow, the northern half of the state will be under winter storm watches and warnings. And the northwest portion of the state could get 10 to 16 inches of snow, possibly more. The rest of the advisory area could get 6 to 13 inches of snow and possibly a wintry mix. Rain in the south tomorrow and highs from the mid-30s to the low 40s.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from T. Rowe Price, offering a strategic investing approach that examines investment opportunities firsthand. Institutions, advisors, employers, and individuals choose T. Rowe Price. T. Rowe Price. Invest with confidence. From Focus Features and Participant, with Dark Waters, a thriller starring Mark Ruffalo and Anne Hathaway. Mysterious deaths in a small town lead one man to risk his life for the truth. Now playing in select theaters, everywhere December 6th. And from Whole Foods Market, offering colors and flavors of the season, with seasonal produce, holiday desserts, and chef-created menus. Whole Foods Market, color the classics.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Steve Inskeep.
And I'm Rachel Martin. The United Kingdom is trying to leave the European Union, but it risks breaking apart in the process. Brexit has fueled talk about a vote that could take Northern Ireland out of Great Britain. NPR's Frank Langfitt reports from Belfast on a disunited kingdom.
Leaving the EU requires Britain to create a new customs border. Prime Minister Boris Johnson wants one that divides Northern Ireland from the rest of the UK. And that means some Northern Irish businesses will have to pay tariffs on products coming from the rest of the country, which would be a little like a company in California paying tariffs on products from Oregon. All this has Chris Suter rethinking how he does business with his homeland. Suter runs Suter Brothers. It's a menswear company in Belfast. And because of the new administrative costs, he may stop buying from the UK and import all his stock from the south, meaning Ireland and the European Union.
I'm a UK business. I'm a UK citizen. I would love to continue our UK relationship. But for the good of the business, if it's tariff-free and admin-free to trade north-south, I will be looking at taking my business there.
Suter says Brexit is a setback for a region or a country, as Northern Ireland is considered, inside the United Kingdom, that's been making a comeback since the political violence of the 1980s.
We were in the doldrums and in the dark ages for so long with the Troubles. Now that that's behind us in the past, this little country has flourished. I think that essence is getting lost in this whole Brexit process, which is sad.
The island of Ireland was partitioned nearly a century ago, dividing the north from the south. The Troubles pitted Catholic nationalists who wanted to reunify the island against Protestant unionists determined to stay a part of the UK. More than 3,600 people died in the conflict, including 13-year-old Leanne Murray, who was killed by an IRA bomb blast in 1993.
Hi, how are you, Gary?
Her brother Gary was on the Shankill Road, which back then was home to many Protestant gunmen, when he heard the explosion.
So I then run straight back down to the rubble and I started digging the best way I could, looking for my sister. It was pandemonium, like, you know, everybody was searching and nobody could find her.
If Brexit draws the North into Ireland's economic orbit, Gary Murray worries that people loyal to Britain will take up arms.
It's really frightening people because of the way things can turn. Rumours are that trouble can be started all over again. I certainly don't want that after what I've been through.
What's your greatest fear?
Going back to the Troubles.
This is Shankill Road, and today people are out walking around shopping, but every couple of blocks, what's so striking is you see a memorial to the dead from the Troubles. Right now I'm looking up at a big archway and a big marble stone that says, in memory of five innocent Protestants slaughtered by IRA gunmen who came and blew up and shot up a bar in 1975.
Shot. Nice, you wolf.
Gordon Young is shooting pool at Wave Trauma Center, which supports victims and survivors of the Troubles. He says by backing a customs border that splits the country, Boris Johnson is selling out Northern Ireland.
The British, the Protestant people, will not accept it. The English should be ashamed of themselves for even voting on this thing, because we're part of the United Kingdom and that's where we belong.
How did you feel when you first heard about the deal, personally?
Betrayed. Let down completely. I'm a Protestant. I'm a Unionist. I believe in the United Kingdom.
Some people are concerned.
What about the Good Friday Agreement?
Well, and just also about reunification eventually.
No, there will be no unification. That's one thing for sure. There'll be a lot of blood spilt before then.
The Good Friday Agreement brought peace to Northern Ireland in 1998. And because the North was in both the EU and the United Kingdom, there was no need for a border. Most people in Northern Ireland wanted to keep it that way and voted against Brexit. Duncan Morrow teaches politics at Ulster University in Belfast.
The problem of Brexit is that Brexit says we need borders, and borders are the opposite of what the Good Friday Agreement was about.
Naomi Long leads Northern Ireland Centrist Alliance Party, which draws support from both Catholics and Protestants. She says Brexit has thrust the question of reunifying the island back on the public agenda.
I didn't think I would see a united Ireland in my lifetime. I expected that it would be a generation or two before that Pandora's box was reopened. But Brexit has reopened that prematurely, and at a time when, frankly, I don't think our society has matured enough to be able to have rational, logical and peaceful conversations about those issues.
A poll in September found a slim majority in Northern Ireland supporting reunification. A far larger majority predicted that a decade from now, a reunification vote would pass. This has fired up Sinn Féin, one of Northern Ireland's largest parties. Once the political arm of the IRA, Sinn Féin is still bent on bringing the two Irelands together, though now through peaceful means. Sinn Féin's John Finucane, he's the Lord Mayor of Belfast, spoke about reunification at a recent community meeting.
Not only is this possible, but I believe it's inevitable in the time ahead. Brexit is a serious, direct threat to Ireland's future political stability and economic prosperity. These changes require new thinking and a radical and innovative response.
I don't think that that is in any way a realistic prospect in the immediate or near future.
Diane Dodds is a member of the European Parliament with Northern Ireland's Democratic Unionist Party, which is devoted to staying in the UK. She said there are big barriers to reunification. For instance, Northern Ireland is one of the UK's poorest regions, relies on more than $13 billion in subsidies from London each year, which Dodds points out the Irish government might have to finance.
The hit to the Republic of Ireland's economy, were it to actually provide the same level for the same levels of services and public services in Northern Ireland, would be just, I think, beyond anything that they could actually manage with.
Which raises the question, would people in Ireland back reunification once they considered the cost? It's unclear how all of this will play out, but Naomi Long of the Alliance Party isn't optimistic.
I think we will be a poorer place as a result of Brexit. I think we will be a more unstable place politically. I think that Northern Ireland's future within the UK is less certain than it has ever been, certainly in my lifetime.
All because of a referendum more than 3 years ago that most people in Northern Ireland voted against. Frank Langford, NPR News, Belfast.
This is NPR News.
From Tahrir Square in Baghdad to the streets of Bogota, Colombia, to a barricaded university in Hong Kong, Protests have broken out all around the world. Is there a common thread? I'm Ari Shapiro, unpacking a season of unrest this afternoon on All Things Considered from NPR News.
Join us for All Things Considered from 4 to 6:30 here on WPR.
You're listening to WGTD HD, Kenosha, Racine, Elkhorn, and Lake Geneva, your gateway to public radio.
It's Morning Edition on WPR, and we'll have the latest news from NPR in just a moment. In Wisconsin news, we'll hear the story of a mythical creature beloved by the town of Rhinelander and a Michigan town that wants to hold a festival around the beast. Details in just a minute.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Dave Mattingly. Iraq's prime minister says he's going to resign. This follows the latest deadly clashes between anti-government protesters and the country's security forces. More than 40 were killed yesterday and at least three more today. NPR's Jane Arraf has more.
The prime minister doesn't say when he will tender his resignation to parliament, but since he's made it public in this manner, he does have to do it. And that actually means that the entire cabinet also resigns. He says he's doing it because of the message from Iraq's most revered Shia cleric, basically saying that there's no confidence left in this government. And a lot of that is because of the dozens of young people killed in protests in the south of Iraq, including the holy city of Najaf over the past few days.
At least 400 protesters have been killed in Iraq since the demonstrations began in October. The Taliban say they're ready to restart peace talks with the U.S. The announcement comes a day after President Trump made an unannounced visit to Afghanistan, where he told reporters at the Bagram Air Base north of Kabul the militant group wants to make a deal to end the 18-year war. Trump canceled negotiations with the Taliban 2 months ago after a bombing in the Afghan capital killed 12 people, including a U.S. soldier. The Taliban claimed responsibility for that attack. This is NPR News from Washington.
This is Wisconsin Public Radio News at 8:31. I'm Melissa Ingalls. Officials in Algoma, Michigan, reached out to Rhinelander to say they wanted to host a local festival themed around the Hodag. That's the green, spiky, mythical creature that has been Rhinelander's mascot since a timber cruiser published the first account of it in 1893. The request has some in town calling on Rhinelander officials to try to ensure the Hodag belongs to them alone. Kerry Bladorn is a local historian. He says the Hodag tale has roots in lumberjack and Native American lore, including in Michigan, but Bladorn says no town has Rhinelander's cultural history with the story.
Rhinelander has a 120-plus year history of molding its identity and building a sense of pride within the Hodag.
Officials in Algoma haven't made their intentions public. Dane County Executive Joe Parisi has included $2 million in the budget for a new type of snowplow that is towed behind a truck and allows one truck to clear two lanes of highway at the same time. The Capital Times reports that the county plans to buy four tow plows and heavy-duty quad-axle trucks. The new technology should improve the county's ability to keep traffic moving during winter storms. Parisi also included $1.4 million to buy four more tri-axle highway trucks to help clear roads. Parisi says keeping the county roads clear during the winter is more difficult due to a growing population and the need for more multi-lane highways. Another storm system is moving into the Great Lakes over the weekend. A winter storm warning goes into effect tomorrow at 6 a.m. for Douglas, Bayfield, Ashland, Iron, Sawyer, and Price counties. Those areas could see total snow accumulations of 10 to 16 inches, possibly more. Some ice accumulations and gusty winds will compound the hazardous conditions. Blizzard conditions are possible near Lake Superior, and the warning lasts through noon Sunday. A winter storm watch is in effect Saturday afternoon through Sunday morning for the rest of the northern half of Wisconsin. Heavy snow and mixed wintry precipitation is possible with accumulations of 6 to 13 inches. A lakeshore flood advisory is in effect Saturday from Sheboygan to Kenosha. Also on Saturday, a gale watch for Lake Michigan with 8 to 10 foot waves possible. Lake Superior will be under a gale warning Saturday night into Sunday with waves of 11 to 16 feet possible. You're listening to news from Wisconsin Public Radio.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from Amazon Studios with The Report, Adam Driver plays a Senate staffer investigating the CIA's post-9/11 tactics, revealing evidence of a government cover-up, with Annette Bening and John Hamm, now on Prime Video. From Charles Schwab, Schwab believes in asking questions and being engaged. Charles Schwab, own your tomorrow. Learn more at schwab.com. And from listeners like you who donate to this NPR station.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Rachel Martin.
And I'm Steve Inskeep. Why would someone kill aid workers who are trying to contain Ebola? Someone did in the Democratic Republic of Congo. They killed four people who'd been working in the eastern part of that African country. The violence has led the World Health Organization to withdraw more than 100 of its workers from the region. Dr. Margaret Harris is among them. She is a spokesperson for the organization and is now in the DRC city of Goma. Welcome to the program.
Thank you very much for having me.
How were the four people killed?
Unfortunately, some groups, guerrilla groups in the area of a place called Biakato Mine, decided to attack the WHO base, which is used as a base of operations, but it's also a camp where the staff live so that they can be close as possible to the areas where people need their help. And this group came in, they were an armed group, they overwhelmed police who were guarding the base and killed two drivers and a vaccinator and injured a lot of other people. Separately, but around the same time, people from the same group, we think, I mean, we don't have confirmation exactly who they were, attacked a center for coordinating the operations in an area called Mangina, about 30 kilometers away, and killed one of the police guarding that particular area.
Do you feel you know why this armed group would attack the WHO?
There has been a constant narrative that Ebola isn't real and that it's being used as a means of earning money by elite groups within the society. We have worked very, very hard and had tremendously good and brave communicators working within communities, and we had actually thought that this belief had been overcome. But with massive unrest in Beni, it seems that the groups that attacked our bases took the opportunity to attack them at that time.
Do you feel you understand why there would be such a theory about the World Health Organization, that you were there somehow to profit rather than to help?
This is a very complex society and complex area. People here have suffered conflict and suffered enormously from outsiders for generations, so for 30 years. So people have grown up here only believing that people who come from outside come to do no good. So it does take a lot of effort, a lot of work, a lot of listening to persuade people that truly people who come from outside and who don't look particularly positive to the local people. We do come in jeeps. We quite often come with armed protection because there have been many killings and many attacks on health workers. We've seen 300 attacks of all kinds. We are used to having our jeeps stoned, for instance, but this is the first time we've had an attack on our bases. So they are not trusting of outsiders. And the key to really working here is to build trust.
It's painful to hear you say that you want to build trust, but because there have been attacks, you bring protection, and then your groups seem large and intimidating. So I have to ask, now that you've had to withdraw World Health Organization people from that region, what are the implications for the fight against Ebola?
We will continue. We are working out how we can continue to stop Ebola. We cannot just walk away, and we have not just walked away. We have removed people who can continue to work safely to safe locations, but we have actually got staff still in those areas, still in Mangina. I am so overwhelmed and impressed by the people who have stayed, including the field coordinator there, a young woman who's just dedicated her life to health and has stayed there to make sure that all her staff are protected.
Dr. Margaret Harris of the World Health Organization, thanks so much.
It's been a pleasure talking to you. Thank you.
6 Democrats have qualified for next month's presidential debate. New Jersey Senator Cory Booker has not.
His campaign is now making a last-ditch effort. NPR's Scott Detrow has more.
When Cory Booker showed up at the New Hampshire State House the other week to officially put his name on the primary ballot, Secretary of State Bill Gardner pointed out a picture of Jimmy Carter. Booker, struggling in the low single digits in poll after poll, immediately leapt for the comparison.
As a former governor, no one had any idea who he was.
He was an underdog, polling 1% this month.
Yeah.
Trust me, and he talked about decency and grace and kindness everywhere he went and ended up winning.
Booker and his campaign set a meticulous, organizing-focused plan when he entered the race in January, and they've stuck to it. He says those metrics, not polls, are what he's looking at.
From the crowds that we're getting that are coming out to my events, to the support from people in New Hampshire donating to my campaign, to, again, leading this campaign in local elected officials who have heft and influence.
Politicians, especially politicians trailing in the polls, love to say the only poll that matters is on Election Day. But that's not the case in this presidential primary. Along with fundraising, early polls determine who gets the visibility of the televised debate stage. While a lot of Democratic voters like Booker, not many are ready to say he's their first choice. So as the debates have gone on, Booker has slowly crept from the middle of the debate stage to the far end of the row, where he was at the last debate.
And we are going to start tonight with Senator Booker. The floor is yours.
Thank you, Rachel. It's an honor to be here tonight. I have not yet qualified for the December stage and need your help to do that. If you believe in my voice and that I should be up here, please go to corybooker.com. Please help.
Booker needs to hit 4% in four polls over the course of 2 weeks. He hasn't done it yet. Two national polls that came out this week had him at 2%. Many of the campaigns that have been cut from debates have complained about the Democratic National Committee's rules. Booker's campaign manager, Adisu Demissi, does not.
Look, I think they're the rules. We're in the game. We're going to play the rules as they've been laid out.
Demissi put out a memo this week detailing how the campaign is trying to make the cut. It's finally going to start spending money on advertising in early voting states. And organizers are going to ramp up efforts to convince people to fully back Booker. So far, Demissi says outreach has mostly focused on introducing the senator and former Newark mayor to voters.
Really, most voters, we believe, are going to be making their decisions, their ultimate decisions about who to vote for in these last 2 months and really probably in the last 2 weeks. And so you got to ramp up your persuasion efforts in this moment, and that's exactly what we're doing.
Booker has a lot of work to do just to make the debate threshold, though, let alone catch frontrunners like Joe Biden. Then again, his campaign message is all about overcoming odds.
Because that's how we do big things in America. We do them together. We beat the Nazis. We beat Jim Crow. When the Russians put up Sputnik, we said, yeah, that's nice, but we're going to the moon together.
Those national polls this week showed between 50 and 64% of Democrats say they could change their mind between now and their primary or caucus. Scott Detrow, NPR News, Washington.
This is NPR News.
Thanks for listening to Wisconsin Public Radio. It's 8:42 right now, and coming up on Morning Edition, 40 years ago, militants seized one of Islam's holiest sites, the Grand Mosque in Mecca, Saudi Arabia. Although short-lived, the siege had profound ramifications in Saudi Arabia and beyond. This piece from NPR's history podcast, Throughline, coming up in 9 minutes.
As a donor to Wisconsin Public Radio, you're part of an amazing group of 54,000 members who share your appreciation of unbiased news, important discussions, and high-quality entertainment. The variety of programs, the information on WPR.org, events in your community, e-newsletters, and so much more, it's all possible thanks to your support. Thank you for making a difference in Wisconsin.
Support for WPR comes from American Transmission Company, operating the electric grid each day and planning pathways for clean, renewable energy in the future. ATC, helping to keep the lights on, businesses running, and communities strong.
Support comes from Sweet Impact Chocolates, Kenosha's producer of premium chocolates dedicated to the ethical treatment of the workers who grow it. Now a vendor at the Grace Fine Art and Craft Festival, 1209 North Broadway, Milwaukee, November 3rd, sweetimpactchocolates.com.
Morning Edition on WPR. Here are some of the major stories of the day. Britain's Conservative Party is complaining to the nation's broadcasting regulator about Channel 4's decision to put Earth-shaped ice sculptures atop podiums in place of Prime Minister Boris Johnson and Brexit Party leader Nigel Farage after they declined to appear for a climate change-themed debate. The party complained to broadcasting watchdog Ofcom over what it called, quote, a provocative partisan stunt. A sheriff says there are no lingering air quality risks a day after two massive explosions rocked a Texas chemical plant, but mandatory evacuations remain in effect due to ongoing danger from flames, explosions, and debris as the fire rages. Environmental Protection Agency spokesman Adam Adams says that while volatile organic compounds were detected by some of the 20 teams monitoring air pollution in the area, none of them detected levels higher than the agency's action level. We'll have all the latest news from NPR and WPR coming up for you in just 15 minutes.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from TIAA, committed to the idea that while most things in life run out, from clean shirts in the morning to a favorite dessert at night, lifetime income in retirement shouldn't. Learn more at TIAA.org/neverrunout. And from CVS Health, where pharmacies are just part of what they do. From MinuteClinic to home care visits to administering intravenous treatments in patients' homes. Learn more at cvshealth.com. Health is everything.
It's 8:45 now and time for Wisconsin Life. Here's producer Maureen McCollum with a story about the Macy's of the North.
A thrift shop in Wisconsin's Northwoods is a stark contrast to the Black Friday scene. Jane Hampton takes us to the store in Minocqua, where deals on clothing, cabin decor, and all kinds of stuff draw bargain hunters from far and wide.
Minocqua is a tourist town, but the cute little gift stores are blocks away from the St. Matthias Thrift Shop. It's a plain brick rectangle that used to be a public service building. On a drizzly morning, dozens of shoppers are lined up before doors open at 10.
Why are you waiting in line in the rain?
Because it's totally worth it.
What's a lucky find?
My best lucky find was a set of dishes. They were like brand new, sold for $100. I got them for $12.
I'm looking for shoes. Shoes that fit and socks.
Finally, the store manager, Jan Degner, unlocks the door.
Are you ready?
Yes!
All right, be nice to each other and have a good time.
Okay.
Degner's a little nervous about this day. It's the big dollar a bag event when shoppers pay a buck for whatever they can jam into a brown paper grocery bag. The shop gets chaotic.
I'm very particular about how it looks out on the floor so that it doesn't look junky, so that things look well-arranged like a regular store. Some people call it the Macy's of the North.
The Macy's of the North definitely has a woodsy vibe. Degner's husband, Gene, runs the furniture side of things.
If it's a upholstered chair and it has animals on it like deer and bear, they love that.
Loons, deer heads. Those and fish mounds are very popular. I think people like to put them up and say they caught them.
Today, though, the hot sellers are dishes, clothing, and toys.
Like, I love to thrift shop. It's thrilling, to be honest.
Winona Careful of Lac de Flambeau has four girls under eight, and the St. Matthias Thrift Shop helps with the budget.
My daughters all have birthdays within about a month of each other, too, so it's a tough time of year.
There's nobody in this neck of the woods that should not have boots, not have a coat, not have furniture.
Barbara Dirksen is one of dozens of local volunteers. She and Degner sift through mountains of donations, everything from junk to gems.
One of our volunteers was going through a bunch of socks that came in, opened up one of the socks, and there was a diamond ring in it. You'll find some that have engraving inside, happy anniversary, and those kind of things. Those are sad. There's many a time we've stood out there in the back room and teared up with family members and hugged, and, you know, there's a lot of personal things going on, too.
What happens is when people sell their cottages, they sell it with all the stuff in it because they don't want it. They don't want to take it home to Chicago. They don't want it. And so now new people buy that house. They don't want that stuff, and it used to go in the dump, and it comes here, and it's perfectly good stuff. They just don't want it. It's not their stuff.
It's a cliche. One person's trash is another one's treasure, but it adds up to big bucks at the thrift shop.
Last year, we gave away $470,000.
The shop gives 10% to the church for outreach and 90% to the community. Dozens of local organizations got grants last year, and yes, they totaled nearly $500,000.
I found it was like a glass goose, and it looked pretty cool.
Are there some clothes in that bag for you?
Yes, a lot.
The thrift store is open all winter, along with a special Christmas shop for the holiday season.
Thank you. Hey, bye-bye, baby.
Bye.
Bye.
See you later. Yes.
Jane Hampton teaches journalism at the University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee and brought us that story on the St. Matthias Thrift Shop in Minocqua. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and PBS Wisconsin in partnership with the Wisconsin Humanities Council. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. Want to make sure you catch every Wisconsin Life story? Subscribe to our podcast. And find more Wisconsin Life at wisconsinlife.org and on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. I'm Maureen McCollum.
Support comes from Sweet Impact Chocolates, an eco-friendly producer of handmade truffles and caramels, where 10% of sales are donated to organizations helping disadvantaged women and children. Shop locally or online. SweetImpactChocolates.com.
Morning Edition takes you on a journey through the issues and keeps you informed about all the campaigns. Listen every day from NPR News.
Ten minutes before nine now, and you're listening to Wisconsin Public Radio. In sports, the Milwaukee Bucks are on the road to play Cleveland tonight at 6:30. The Wisconsin Badgers women's basketball team hosts Ball State tonight at 6. The Marquette men's team beat the Davidson Wildcats yesterday 73-63. They play USC this afternoon. The Marquette women play St. Mary's at 4 today, and the Packers play the Giants on Sunday. Flurries and freezing drizzle possible today, highs in the mid to upper 30s, and then the northern half of the state will be under winter storm watches and warnings Saturday and Sunday.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Rachel Martin.
And I'm Steve Inskeep. Let's take a trip back in the history of extremism. We'll go back to a moment before ISIS existed. Before 9/11, before many people had ever heard of Osama bin Laden. 40 years ago, extremist militants attacked the holiest shrine of Islam. It's in Mecca, in Saudi Arabia. And this story will show that that attack, 4 decades ago, set the stage for many of the events that followed. NPR's history podcast, Throughline, has examined this attack in a recent episode, and we're joined now by one of the show's hosts, Ramtin Arablouei. Good morning.
Thanks for having me.
So how did this all begin?
Well, in the late 1970s, Saudi Arabia was going through a transformation, thanks to the discovery of oil, which brought in revenues that led to modernization.
Oh, conservative society suddenly opened up to the world and able to afford it.
That's right. Along with improved education, healthcare, and infrastructure, there were social changes. Women were able to go to the beach in bathing suits, not having to cover up. They were on TV. People could go to movie theaters. And these things may not seem like a big deal, but they marked the growing influence of secular Western culture in the country.
Who in Saudi Arabia was bothered by this?
Many conservatives in Saudi Arabia, including this one guy named Juhayman al-Otaibi. He had served in Saudi Arabia's army for many years, and he became more and more interested in Islam and more interested in conservative thought.
Mm-hmm.
He felt that these changes were taking Saudi Arabia away from Islam and were changing the kind of view of the country that he had had up to that point. So he and his followers decided they were going to do something about it, that they had to remove the Saudi government. And they had a radical plan to do that. My co-host Rund Abdel Fattah and I tell the story. The morning of November 20th, 1979 would have seemed like any other in Mecca.
Roughly 100,000 pilgrims from around the world gathered in Islam's holiest site. Just as the prayer ended, shots rang out. This wasn't a sound any pilgrim expected to hear. Violence is strictly forbidden in Mecca.
Juhayman al-Otaibi, the leader of the mission, charged the pulpit and snatched the mic away from the mosque's imam. In a thick Bedouin accent, he instructed his men.
If you see a government soldier who wants to raise his hand against you, have no pity and shoot him, because he wants to kill you.
Juhayman and his followers had seized the Grand Mosque, taking nearly 100,000 scared, panicking hostages.
The siege of Mecca had begun.
As word of the siege began seeping out of Mecca, the Saudis realized they needed to end it quick. And to do that, they had to stage an actual full-scale military assault. But remember, it's forbidden in Islam to commit acts of violence in Mecca.
So they needed fatwa from the religious authorities that would authorize the operation.
This is Yaroslav Trofimov.
I've been covering the Muslim world for nearly two decades for the Wall Street Journal.
After days of frustration, the Saudi king summoned the leading members of the clergy, the ulama, to negotiate.
What were the specific demands?
The demands were, for example, more restrictions of women's rights. But most importantly, what they wanted is the spreading the view of Islam to the rest of the misguided Muslim nations. And they needed the backing of the Saudi state for that.
We have to stop for a second here and emphasize the importance of this moment. Up until 1979,
the Al-Saud had made a very specific arrangement, deal with the religious establishment. There is no interference in each other's business.
This is Joe Kashishian.
I'm a senior fellow at the King Faisal Center for Research in Islamic Studies.
The Saudis feared that this arrangement could be in jeopardy if the ulama were able to extract these new demands. But Joe says, even knowing the risks, there really weren't many options for King Khalid and the royal family.
He had no choice but to acquiesce to the demands.
They said, okay, we will support you in this critical moment. We will authorize the military operation in the holiest of holies. But in exchange, you will allow us to use the resources of the Saudi state to further our cause throughout the Muslim Ummah, the Muslim nation.
It took 3 long days for the clerics to pen the fatwa allowing for Saudi authorities to use violence to take back the Grand Mosque. This is audio of a message Saudi authorities blasted into the mosque over loudspeakers, pleading with the militants to end the takeover.
This call was answered with fire and murderous acts on the Muslims by these renegades.
Juhayman didn't end it. So within hours of the fatwa being issued, the Saudi forces began their assault to take back the Grand Mosque.
It was very chaotic. It was an environment where everybody was panicking.
By the end of the day, many of the militants were dead, and dozens were arrested, including Juhayman himself. The siege had failed. More than 60 people were arrested,
including Juhayman al-Otaibi. They were all tried.
And then they were all beheaded.
What are the ramifications of this event on Saudi Arabia and the world?
It stopped the modernization of Saudi Arabia's society for a very long time.
Saudi Arabia became a very conservative country after 1979. For example, movie theaters were banned. The condition of women became much more difficult. So a dark chapter really started in the country.
And at the same time, it empowered the conservative clerics of Saudi Arabia to not just control the social developments in the kingdom, but to export their very austere conservative vision of Islam around the world, where it was really very marginal up until then, and something that really fostered the development of jihadi groups and extremist groups from Nigeria to Indonesia.
Ramtin, I think I'm beginning to understand how that attack would be the backdrop of so many things we've seen in more recent years.
Yeah, and even though Juhayman's mission ultimately failed, that 15-day hostage-taking had a lasting effect on other extremists, and we're still seeing the consequences of that play out today.
A story from 1979 from Ramtin Arablouei of NPR's Throughline podcast. Thanks for coming by.
Thank you, Steve.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. Our theme music was inspired by BJ Lederman. I'm Steve Inskeep.
And I'm Rachel Martin.
I'm Melissa Ingalls. Big thanks to our producer, Hannah Haynes, who makes us sound good all week long. Morning Edition is on the air every weekday from 5 to 9 here on Wisconsin Public Radio. To follow developments throughout the day, visit WPR.org. There you can see statewide reports from WPR's award-winning news team. The latest headlines are coming up next.
Support for WPR comes from Explore La Crosse, featuring Rotary Lights, November 25th through the end of the year. Set along the Mississippi with Santa nightly, outdoor skating, and more than 4 million lights. ExploreLacrosse.com.
Support for WGTD comes from Piasecki Funeral Home. Would you like classical music played in your honor at your funeral? Contact the compassionate, caring staff at Piasecki to plan requests. Piasecki Funeral Home, serving the community since 1931.